Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Judge Bartley, and I'm joined today by Judge Meredith to my right and Judge Laura to my left. We're here today for the matter of Karen R. Charette versus Dennis McDonough, docket number 23-7775. Before us is Ms. Charette's petition filed in December of 2023. So, counsel for the parties, please state your name and your appearance for the record, beginning with appellant's counsel. Thank you, Mr. Rosinski.
Mark McNabb, the Secretary.
Thank you, Mr. McNabb.
And Mark Hamill, the Secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Hamill. As you know, each party will have 30 minutes to present argument. Mr. Rosinski, you want to reserve 15 minutes?
Yes, sir.
Okay, all right, we will do that. And you may proceed when you're ready, Mr. Rosinski.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. One thing that we know about this case is that the Secretary is not the fiduciary, and he is limited to an oversight role of the fiduciaries appointed by the VA. How we know that is the Secretary himself stated that in his 2014 overhaul rulemaking. Charette's arguments in this case are based on that limitation or the violation of that limitation by the Secretary in his fiduciary service. Despite two petitions, now two oral arguments, over a dozen rulings by this court, and over two dozen notices and motions and responses in the two petitions, we still do not know what authority the Secretary asserts for the actions and inactions he has taken in this case, particularly action to withhold the familial benefits that were in our approved benefit fund arrangement, which he himself has characterized in another Federal Register notice as a binding contract on the parties, binding contract between the VA and the fiduciary. He has violated that also. And I intend to discuss that.
Well, Mr. Rosinski, let's start off with some questions. So what is it exactly that you want us to do? And after you tell us that, would you just address our jurisdiction to indeed accomplish that relief for Ms. Charette?
Yes, Your Honor. The court has jurisdiction over fiduciary matters as discussed in Freeman. It's not limited to appointment. It's limited. It's broad authority, as we have put in our papers in this case as well. We want what Ms. Charette is looking for is to get the benefits to which she was receiving, or the payments from her husband's benefits, which she was receiving under an approved budget that were cut off by the Secretary's unilateral direction to the fiduciary who replaced her. Again, if you recall, replaced her under very suspicious circumstances, which was admitted in open court were incorrect and the court found troubling. She has now been reappointed as fiduciary and is seeking to be appointed as spouse payee for reasons which were also brought to attention to the court, and wants that money paid. I think actually that we understand what the amount is. It's not insignificant. It's over $300,000 at this point. And the reason that the court should order that is only during this window when she was accused of misuse has this money been withheld. Both before and after, the Secretary agreed that she was needed 3,000 plus, between 3,200 and 3,800 different times, a month to support herself and her family. Only during that period, the Secretary said, no, you're not to pay it.
And so is that the, and you would you address jurisdiction like what? But also, is that the only thing that you're asking for? Because you went into a little spiel about Loper Bright and et cetera?
Yes, Your Honor. I think at this point, the Secretary has opened, has taken the top off of all the authority of the Secretary. He continues to come up with reasons to delay or reasons to get Mrs. Chaurette again removed or somehow restricted. That includes this not living with her husband, and even in that response where they pulled it back, they said, but we're going to look again in the record and see if we can find anything else we can use to not allow her to be a spouse payee. That is ultra-virus action that has no connection to her as the spouse and a dependent of Mr. Charette. All of this other noise was generated because the VA in its ways in the fiduciary found and tried to get her removed because she didn't buy the right kind of trousers for her husband. That is in the record, and they have admitted that.
And so you said there was an opening, the Secretary opened the door for something broader. You're talking about broader relief for us to investigate the fiduciary program,
yes.
Or what's...
Yes, Your Honor. I, next point, the Secretary's authority under the grant from Congress for a fiduciary program, even though he hasn't stated it, is solely limited to Section 5502A1, which is limited to designating the payee. He can designate the beneficiary, he can designate a spouse or family member, or he can designate a fiduciary. There is no other authority granted to the Secretary. Designate the payment. What the Secretary has done, and I'm prepared to talk in as much detail as the court would like to hear, has turned the fiduciary from the defined fiduciary by Congress in 5506 into essentially a bank teller. Gets the money, pays it out. The Secretary doesn't like what they're paying out, they tell the fiduciary, don't pay it out anymore. That is well beyond any authority. Now, Secretary may have something else. He has not stated it in any of those 24 other filings. That's why I reserved the extra time, because I don't know what they're going to say. But I'll tell you that the program is only authorized to direct payments. Nothing about filing tax returns, nothing about going outside of VA benefits. The language is specifically benefits authorized by statutes, the Secretary's statute, not Social Security, not private equity, not private funds, nothing else. That is a broad programmatic problem. And that all opened up and is exemplified by Mrs. Charette's problem. They want to know about her Social Security number. It's in their own forms. He gets this much VA, he gets this much Social Security, he gets this much retirement. They base their budget on that.
And so, Mr. Rosinsky, would you address, you're asking for two things. One is fairly narrow, give her these back familial expense benefits. I shouldn't call them benefits, but familiar expense reimbursements, yeah. And the second thing is this, some kind of broader relief, finding that the Secretary's actions in this matter are ultra vires. So can you address our jurisdictional authority for each of those?
Well, I believe they're both the same, under the same statute. That statute, which gives the only designation of authority to the Secretary, however it's interpreted, is already been found under Freeman as related to the provision of benefits. Indeed, it states it's related, you pay benefits in this manner. I don't know how more related to benefits you can get. The court has jurisdiction over that. And, also, if the court doesn't have jurisdiction over it, there is no jurisdiction over it, because I personally have brought 3 district court cases on fiduciary matters, and in each case, they have said, this is a veterans court. We have no jurisdiction. Uh-huh. So if the secretary argues otherwise, I'd like to hear the case, because there's dozens of cases, not only mine, but that say fiduciary matters are off limits, even for Federal Tort Claim Act purposes, which is what I also brought it under. So this court has jurisdiction, or there's no jurisdiction over the secretary's fiduciary program. I do and not so, think there's any interpretation of Congress's grant of jurisdiction that says they're immune. And you would have to overrule Freeman.
And so so you're saying basically under 511, this would qualify.
Yes, now, same basis as previous.
But we know there's a little, there's some more restrictions for fiduciary decisions under 16200 is going into my head, but might be 400, talking about what is appealable, the appealable decisions. And so are you trying to characterize, especially your authorizing of the familial expenses, what would that fall under in terms of that regulation?
Again, I don't remember the number, but the secretary has taken the very provocative position on that rule that he can determine what can be appealed in this court. I think I challenged that somewhat in one of my filings, but I have no understanding of the authority where the secretary can say, Freeman says you can appeal this broad group of cases, and we say, only these six, or whatever it is. I think that whole thing should be thrown out on its face.
And so you're not trying to, it's 13,600. I was close, but not there. So are you trying to fit this argument about the familial expenses, the family expenses, into one of those categories? And if so, which one?
No, I'm not. I'm telling you that if you find that if you reach that statute or that rule, it should be thrown out. The secretary cannot tell this court what could and could not be heard under Freeman. Freeman says what Freeman says. You're tasked with deciding what cases can come under, although there's also, the secretary said, it's much broader than that. There's rulemakings. I may have one with me, but it is not limited to challenging the fiduciary. It's fiduciary issues. And if I may, one key point here is same thing. The definition of fiduciary, Congress defined what a fiduciary is, right? A fiduciary is a position of trust and or someone who's designated to issue payments, okay, to make payments. The secretary truncated that into only the last part and deleted an important part about in a representative position. Congress wanted a fiduciary to be a fiduciary, representing the interests of the beneficiary. You can look up in Black's, you can use any dictionary. None of them have a definition that allows a third party to tell a fiduciary what to do. Yet this case exemplifies, and all the other ones I cited, I have the citations, the 8 or 9 or 10 that I've personally been involved in, the secretary meddles and tells them what to do. Every budget is a contract. That's further emphasizing the out-of-control, ultra-virus approach. They're using a contract, a form, to precondition. You will accept all the terms and conditions, including we set the budget, or you're not appointed a fiduciary. They're doing by contract what Congress did not give them authority to do.
Could I clarify what the chief was asking you originally is what relief you're seeking here? Part of the things that we talked about in all of the various pleadings that you mentioned was the receipt of the fiduciary file, which at some point VA provided Mrs. Shurrett with a copy of it. But in one of your later pleadings, you suggested that they have denied her an updated copy. Is that still part of
that? That is still part of it. I was just informed before we came in that supposedly that update was delivered to me yesterday when I was here preparing it, not unexpected development. But there again, there may be other things in there. We found a lot of interesting stuff. But why we have to go over and over every time, come to this court to get a copy of the fiduciary file every single time is another issue of why do we have to do that?
So one other item that's mentioned in all the pleadings that you discuss is from your sixth Sauls notice, mm-hmm. it appears that by herself, through current counsel, Mrs. Charette has filed a misuse allegation against the former paid fiduciary. Can you just clarify for us that that's a separate matter? That's not part of the current litigation?
That was information for the court. That, again, the resolution of that is more troubling than anything else. Mrs. Charette took the CDs that the former fiduciary had bought, which were all long-term principal penalty CDs. And argued that's a violation of the don't do anything stupid with the guy's money kind of rule. And that was dismissed in a couple of days. And I submitted the evidence that VA told the guy, don't sweat it or don't worry about it, and just dismissed it. So that's just a side light of kind of the context we're working in. Everything is Mrs. Charette's fault. And the secretary won't say. Agencies, including the VA and its fiduciary program can only operate under explicit authority from Congress. So, we are still waiting to hear what that is for the things that I have produced here.
Counsel, could I follow up on the jurisdictional question that the chief was asking about? Your request to have Mrs. Charette reimbursed for the family expenses she didn't receive from 2018 to 2024. In October 2023, you sent a letter to VA demanding that they restart her $3,000 or so dollars a month in expenses that she was being paid from the Veterans Disability Compensation. But you also asked for reimbursement of the amounts she had not been paid. Has VA responded to you as to that letter?
No.
May I follow up on that? I'm sorry. So I wanted to ask you, Mr. Rosinski, in the filing that the secretary made on March 21st of 2024, it's titled Respondent's Provision of Supplemental Information. There is an exhibit which includes a letter sent to Mr. Payne, who was designated as the successor fiduciary, that directs him to provide a check to Mrs. Charette that includes the ending account balance as of the date of the letter, which was March 18th of 2024. So you're saying that Mr. Payne never did that? He never provided a check to Mrs. Charette in the amount of that equals the balance in the fiduciary account?
He did. The problem was most of the money was invested in long-term CDs. When Mrs. Charette demanded the cash, okay, the CDs were sold, and again, I'm not sure who physically ordered it, but the CDs were sold, and they actually lost a couple, $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 to get the cash to fund the check. Mrs. Charette has no argument. She has all the funds from Mr. Payne. Her argument was, why did he invest it in such a way that we lost principal, not just interest, but lost principal. The man is gravely ill, and he bought 10-year CDs. You know, so that was the argument in the misuse. She has all the money. We have no dispute with Mr. Payne other than that.
So that's an allegation of misuse by the successor fiduciary. But what was the amount of the check? What was the balance? Documents?
The balance in the account now is something around $290,000. Total, and we have no dispute with the amount that she received.
When did Mrs. Charette receive that check, and what was the amount?
When she was, I don't know the exact amount, but I know she received the check, and the CDs may. I don't know the amount of the check. I don't know that there's $290,000 approximately in the account now.
But Mr. Rosinski, can you clarify? That was not any kind of payment for familial expenses.
No.
It was
a trust fund transfer under Mrs. Charette was reappointed after prompting from the court, and Mr. Payne gave her all the money he had in the trust fund. It just got depleted because a lot of it had been invested in CDs, which in, it's not unreasonable to do that. It's unreasonable, we thought, we argued and were denied, that it was unreasonable to buy these long-term CDs for a man who is gravely ill and hasn't left the hospital for a decade or more. So that is a side issue, but the response to me is the important point.
But when you use the term familiar expenses, what you're talking about is everything except for the amount that was paid to the successor fiduciary for managing the account, as well as the bond that was required as a non-spouse or non-family fiduciary. Is that correct?
It's
the monthly amount.
It was a monthly amount
from the VA.
She was getting approximately something, you know, between $1,800 and $2,800, depending on which period we're talking about. But it was what the secretary did when Mr. Payne was appointed. Told Mr. Payne he was authorized to make two payments. One payment was $100 or so, $150, I believe, a month to Mr. Charette's patient fund, you know, petty cash for him to spend, and his fee. Nothing else. And that's on a document that's before you. And that's all. None of the other dozen things, mortgage, utilities, food, stuff, all that disappeared. Okay? That's why we're saying it was withheld. Secretary had no authority to do that. He had no authority to direct any budget. Mrs. Charette was never contacted on it. And you see, all of a sudden, nothing, zero, went to the family. What? I mean...
Counsel, can I turn back to the jurisdictional question that I was starting to ask you about earlier? So you've sent a request to VA to have Mrs. Charette reimbursed for the monthly payments that she didn't receive from 2018 to 2024. In the August 2024 filing that the secretary submitted, they've acknowledged that it would be VA, the fiduciary hub, that would make a decision as to whether or not she can take a reimbursement from that account that we were just talking about. So if VA responded to your request, made a determination, yes or no, that she's entitled to some reimbursement, is that a 511A question? Is it a decision under a law affecting the provision of benefits that could be appealable?
It is. It's ultra vires because she is the fiduciary. She has the money here, and VA is demanding approval that she put it over here. Okay, there's no dispute that she's stealing it. There's no dispute it doesn't owed, okay, or the amount. We're not even arguing about the amount. I don't remember exactly. It's 280-something thousand, okay? And that is exactly what my initial argument was. They have no authority to do that.
So you're not looking for a decision from VA as to whether she can get reimbursement?
No. They won't give us the money unless we agree to what Mrs. Charette considers unauthorized intrusion. She is the fiduciary in one of her roles. She is the beneficiary. Nobody should be in between them. And judging on all the things, which the court is very well aware of what the secretary has done or the fiduciary people have done in the last year, okay, separation, you know, she abandoned the husband, all this stuff that they've said and continue to base a lot of it on the misuse finding that has been revoked. They don't have authority to demand what they're demanding.
If you're not looking for a decision from VA on some question that falls under 511A, how do we get to jurisdiction? What is it that we could direct VA to do that would lead to a board decision that could be appealed here?
The letters to Mr. Payne that deleted all of these approved funds is illegal and ultra vires and exceeds the secretary's authority. If we could have appealed that to the board, we'd make the same argument. Show us where the secretary can tell a fiduciary, Mr. Payne was duly appointed, that he cannot pay what the beneficiary and his family need to maintain the standard of living. I forget, it's also a requirement of the fiduciary. And how the secretary can intrude on the fiduciary inherent authority granted by Congress in the statute that I identified where they specifically define fiduciary. and the secretary hasn't. And that's the root of all evil here. The secretary's turned the fiduciary, any fiduciary, Mrs. Charette, Mr. Payne, all of them, into an agent. You do what I say or I fire you. That's as clear as it gets. And the jurisdiction issue is that it's under the fiduciary program, which is under the statute that affect, the, in this case, directly affect the provision of benefits as directed. And again, there is no other court. And it was very frustrating to hear from the district court. They had to come back to this court. And now we're back. Freeman says you have authority to do this. You can redo the analysis. This directly affects the provision of benefits to Mr. Charette, because he also has to go through the fiduciary to get his money, as well as Mrs. Charette get the money. It's right there. If this isn't, I mean, I don't know how much more direct he can be. The secretary directs the payment of benefits in that statute. That statute conveys direct authority on this court to intervene on when the secretary violates that. And again, I'm very interested in hearing all these ancillary things of fiduciary people do, intruding into especially Social Security, taking checkbooks out of houses, and basing budgets on information that has nothing to do with the provision of benefits at all, whether to the beneficiary or to the family or even to the fiduciary. And I ask you to look very closely at the definition of fiduciary by Congress, and whether the secretary's definition can stand. That's why I say this has grown in time with the case, because, like I said, over a year ago, we were here almost exactly a year ago. I think we did it remotely then. But it is now reported in the USC as one of the cases. That's how long we have been dancing with the fiduciary program. And it cannot be lost that they have instituted this binding contract because they don't have authority otherwise. That's my submittal. If you take away the restrictions in those contracts, which, by the way, they have a fast letter that addressed that.
Mr. Rosinski.
1213.
Mr. Rosinski. Given Judge Meredith's questions and some of Judge Laura's questions, is one of the things that you're also seeking is a decision on the matter that you did raise to the secretary, a decision on the release of funds perhaps the failure to release funds could be considered misuse?
Well, Mr. Payne is history as far as we're concerned. We got the money. I think it exposes problem.
What I'm talking about the familial expenses portion.
What we want is authorization, an order from the court that Mrs. Charette is authorized to repay family payments that were not paid since the date, I think we agreed, 2018, March 2018. There's no dispute over the dates and the periods and the amounts. That mostly look for a guarantee, because we've tried a few things and we get slapped with you've abandoned your spouse, and we get slapped with you didn't ask for this. An order from the court that is the way it's going to be.
That as a fiduciary, she can pay herself the back due familial expenses.
I guess we need to address the issue of receipts, which rose. We challenged it and went back down. I don't know what they're going to do. I need it as general enough to prevent interference from the fiduciary people, which, quite frankly, I'm not sure are going to listen to this man or the secretary, because they haven't in the past. So that's the other issue, whether they're actually controlled. But a no way out, pay the woman. If we need to get the exact numbers and dates, I'm sure we can agree and make a submittal. But that is our concern. We've been here now, like I said, 2 years.
Counsel, and how would that be an aid of the court's jurisdiction to award that? Aid of our jurisdiction to award that relief?
Because if they would have said, no, statute XYZ prevents that, or statute XYZ or whatever regulation or back pocket writing says we don't have to do it. We could bring it to the board, wait 5 years, and bring it back to the court. They have shown no, they have refused to do it. You said, I sent letters. We've been in court. 20-something motions. They're aware of this problem. I sent the demand letter specifically to avoid them saying, well, she never told us she wanted the money. How many times in the filings have they said, she didn't ask for this. She didn't tell us there was a problem. It's not her job to point out what the secretary cannot do. He's supposed to tell us and you why he can do what he's gonna do or did. They keep telling Mrs. Charette, you know, hey, we did it, why can't we do it? Or you didn't tell us that we should do that. No one that I've ever run across in my 20 years working in the fiduciary program has had to ask for a budgeted benefit. Right? And on top of it, they took it out. It was, and they acted to take it out.
So I hesitate to go back to this, but I will. In the petition of December of 2023, the petitioner specifically requested a writ from this court to pay Mrs. Charette the total amount of, quote, expenses withheld from her beginning in April, it says 2023, I suspect that's probably 2018, now exceeding $224,000.
If that was a date typo, but yes.
Okay, so the date was a typo, but that amount increased. But if I heard you correctly, and you called it the trust fund that Mr. Payne, the successor fiduciary, cut a check to Mrs. Charette. Is that what you're talking about, or is this something else? What is the expenses withheld?
Mr. Payne took over the amount from Mrs. Charette when she got
2018.
There was some money. Okay. He has been receiving the money, and he's been paying out a little bit of money.
So the money includes disability from VA.
So, yeah, we have no dispute. The funds grew, the excess, and again, that's one of their charges. Oh, Mrs. Charette's, you know, not paying out enough money. He didn't pay out any money. He paid out $100-something instead of $3,000, so it grew. All right, the amount was transferred. Check was transferred. Ms. Charette, she's happy with what she received, other than it should have been more because he invested it poorly. But other than that, we have no dispute over how or what she got, other than the one we made, which was rejected.
So that part of the petition is moot.
Yes, she has control of the money. No. She never, of that money, she's owed about 90% of it. They didn't, he was only paying out $100 or $200 a month. He should have been paying out almost $3,800 a month or whatever.
But now as the fiduciary, she's in control of that.
She could write herself a check. There would still be, I believe it's around $20,000 left in the account, which for, VA is arguing now, their latest thing is that, oh, we need to keep enough so the VA is not stuck with burying the man. Well, trust me, $20,000 is enough for this man who's been in the hospital for 20-something years, all his expenses paid by the government. All that is left is to bury the man, and he has left more than enough money to do that if she pays herself. What we object to is having to ask permission from the secretary to do that, and I'll read from FAST letter 1213, effective immediately, April 19th, 2012, VA-appointed fiduciaries do not need to seek prior VA approval for any single expenditure made on behalf of a beneficiary, regardless of the amount of the expenditure or whether it is listed on a VA form 214703, which is the fiduciary agreement. That grew out of a comment that my firm at the time made that they had the opposite in the rulemaking and pointed out fiduciaries do not need to seek authority if they break their agreements by acting out of bounds. The secretary certainly has oversight. But they do not have to ask. And the secretary himself said it. This was by David McClatchin, the director of the pension and fiduciary group at the time, who I worked with a lot at the time. That's still effective. And if it wasn't, it would still be the meaning of the law.
And yet, Mr. Brzezinski, in the secretary's, I think it was the latest submission response to our order, the fiduciary service and the secretary himself were arguing that it would be against VA's regulation for her to pay herself. Is that, I just want a one-word answer. That's correct.
Self-dealing, a great oversight. How is it self-dealing if everybody agrees? She should pay herself the money. That's why I need the court order, because I know we've got hints. Oh, just write yourself a check. We'd be back. She'd be misused. She'd be reported to the IRS before I got to court, because that's what they have done every single time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Brzezinski. I appreciate your arguments. And Mr. McNabb, you may proceed. You have an additional 19 minutes if you need it.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. For the secretary, I'm Mark McNabb, and with me at the council table is Mark Hamill. The secretary urges the court to deny the petition. One pending matter remains before the agency, and there has been no substantial delay in that matter. In the August 8th, 2024 declaration provided by the fiduciary service, VA conceded that the basis for its choice of appointment type for Mrs. Charette as fiduciary was based on an error. And a new appointment as the less restrictive spouse payee has been initiated. I understand that an initial call to Mrs. Charette about that matter was made the following day. VA will follow its procedures for making a new appointment, and assuming Mrs. Charette participates with those processes as she did in her recent appointment, this action will be completed within 45 days of it beginning. No other VA action remains pending. No VA decisions are required based on any communication in the file. Accordingly, the petition should be denied. Mrs. Charette is now the VA-appointed fiduciary. Pursuant to 38 CFR 13140, she has the responsibility to make payment decisions in the interest of the beneficiary.
The beneficiary and the beneficiary's dependents, isn't that the role?
Yes, Your Honor. She's doing so on behalf of the beneficiary to serve the beneficiary and the dependents.
Uh-huh. And I thought that that your position was that it would violate the fiduciary rules for her to pay essentially herself, because not only is she the fiduciary, she is a dependent of the beneficiary.
No, Your Honor, that's not correct. And insofar as VA recently responded to the court's query regarding whether the fiduciary needed to seek VA's permission to reimburse herself for expenses incurred during the period when someone else served as the fiduciary and from whom she sought no direct aid from that successor fiduciary, I would like to clarify that the affirmative response given in that pleading meant to indicate that a fiduciary seeking and receiving VA's, quote, permission in advance of that use of funds would simply ensure her that VA did not find such a dispersal to be a misuse or otherwise failure to properly fulfill the duties of a fiduciary such that removal might be appropriate. So she doesn't need it. She needs it to know that that sort of dispersal of 95% of the funds would not be seen as misuse in advance. However, she is empowered to make that payment if that's what she thinks is in the best interest of the veteran fulfills her duties under 13.140. Those are the duties of the fiduciary. Counsel expressed in his local bright presentation that 38 CFR 1320 that talked about the receipt of funds was sort of the extent of what VA regulated in response to the statute, but that's simply not true. That completely ignores the existence of 38 CFR 13140 that lays out that a fiduciary receives the VA payment on behalf of a beneficiary in the fiduciary program must fulfill certain responsibilities associated with the services of a fiduciary. And those are listed in 13140. Those include disbursing and otherwise managing funds according to the best interest, quote, according to the best interest of the beneficiary and the beneficiary's dependents, and in light of the beneficiary's unique circumstances, needs, desires, beliefs, and values. That's 13.140A1. The regulation includes a description of the fiduciary's primary financial responsibilities, which include but are not limited to a variety of other duties that are listed in 13.140, and those include the use of the beneficiary's VA benefits under management only for the care, support, education, health, and welfare of the beneficiary and his or her dependents. They also include protection of the beneficiary's VA benefits from loss or diversion, maintaining separate accounts, determining the beneficiary's just debts.
So, Mr. McNabb, in the Secretary's, I think it was a response from April 4th, supplemental information, I think you called it, didn't you include there a budget that the fiduciary was bound to follow?
It did include a budget, but as we explained in our pleading, they were not bound. It's not a binding document. It is information gathered for VA who has oversight duties and for the fiduciary. In this case, the fiduciary is a spouse who may be well aware of the expenses, but that's not always the case. But what they do is produce this budget. They gather information through a field exam and then produce this, but it is not in any way binding. And it is a tool that from VA's side is helpful in oversight when accountings are turned in or VA otherwise requests an update on the status of the funds under
management. And so all fiduciaries are made aware specifically that they don't have to follow that. It's literally like they could throw it out the window and do something entirely different without VA's interference.
Well, they can do so if they are following the guidance of for instance, 13.140.
That, are they following? You mean if the fiduciary service is following the guidance?
No, Your Honor. That the fiduciary must follow their duties.
Yeah.
And that if they fail to follow, and VA's job is to oversee and make sure that they are the acting in the best interest of the veteran, and if they're not fulfilling those duties, to replace them.
Well, how does VA do that without telling them what to do, which they seem to do in this case?
No, Your Honor. They have a conversation about needs, and then they produce this budget that gives VA an idea when it then reviews what might be out of the ordinary or what, and then they sort of, it gives them information so that they know what questions to ask in their oversight role.
And so, okay, well, maybe we have a different view of what this case is about, but I mean, this whole case started, as Mr. Rosinsky pointed out, by a VA psychologist or social worker finding that the veteran needed a new pair of pants and that Ms. Charette wasn't providing the kind of pair of pants that the social worker thought she should provide. Can you just answer yes or no? Was that the beginning of this whole case?
Your Honor, I believe there were additional problems. That is, for instance, I believe the veteran wanted to have additional funds to go out to eat and that sort of thing that were declined. It's my understanding that she was initially removed because they determined she was not acting in the best interest of the veteran, so someone else was appointed to act as fiduciary. When that happened, then VA then followed their procedures, had a new field exam, and that is where Mrs. Charette refused to participate. She would not give any information or speak to the person conducting that field exam, and that is the reason that the budget that was then produced for
didn't
the fiduciary.
Didn't she ask them to talk to her lawyer at that field exam?
I believe she did say that if they had any
Did
other,
you?
I'm unaware of that any contact.
So you can't blame it on her that she didn't cooperate. She asked you to call her lawyer.
Your Honor, that is in the record. I also know that the record shows that she then never expressed a need for funds from the VA funds. And then when she did so, she was told, it's the fiduciary who makes decisions, contact the fiduciary. And then she didn't do so. And when the fiduciary was asked, near concluding his time serving as the fiduciary, had Mrs. Charette ever contacted her about any need whatsoever? And the answer was no. And so the fiduciary...
Doesn't VA have an obligation itself? Your field examiners have an obligation to assess the financial situation of the beneficiary and the dependents. That's the VA employee that's supposed to look at, not just what the veteran needed, but what his dependents needed. That's Mrs. Charette. Did they do that in this time between 2018 and 2024?
I, Whether the field exam conducted in 2018 was adequate, I could not say. But what I
VA didn't take any proactive steps, and Mr. Charette was writing to VA all the time saying, you turned off my payments. Did VA take any steps to reach out to the fiduciary to initiate a corrective action that one of the dependents wasn't being taken care of?
I don't believe they contacted the fiduciary. When she called them and expressed that she needed funds, they explained to her that she needed to contact the fiduciary, and she chose not to do so.
But you're saying that VA doesn't have any role in that process, and that's not what your regulations suggest. The field examiner is supposed to assess the dependent's needs, and it sounds like that didn't happen here. And to take corrective action, you did when the field examiner thought that Mr. Charette was not getting enough funds. They took corrective action. But Mrs. Charette wasn't entitled to the same actions?
Your Honor, that information should have been gathered, and it should have been given to the fiduciary. However, then she simply needed to only contact that fiduciary to explain that
contacted VA.
You can't with a straight face say she simply needed to contact. I mean, the record is replete, both in the earlier petition and this one, that she did so multiple times.
That her counsel did, for instance, say, please return this, give her
and,
these
and
funds.
Her counsel is her.
Oh, yes, sir.
In VA's eyes.
Of course, Your Honor.
Okay.
And then, but the first time she expressed a need, document that shows that conversation shows that she expressed for the first time a need for the funds and was told, please contact the fiduciary.
And are the dependents, is this a needs-based program?
Is it a needs-based?
Like awarding family benefits.
There is no
expenses.
There's no awarding of the benefits to veterans, and the benefit flowed.
I get it. So I used the wrong word.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, but that has been the way that it's been phrased throughout, and we don't think that's
accurate. Well, familial expenses. Isn't that the term that you use, or what term would you use here?
Yes, Your Honor. So, I mean, your question was, should the prior fiduciary have...
Yeah, you said she didn't show that she needed it.
She didn't express any need.
And where is that in a regulation somewhere, that she expressed need? Or
You're right, Your Honor, that the fiduciary's duty... the prior fiduciary's duty was to gather information about that, and there's no indication that was the case. But that fiduciary has been replaced, and that fiduciary...
So, and what regulation are you talking about whenever you say that it's the field examiner's duty to assess the needs?
Oh, no, that was Judge Meredith, Your Honor. I was saying that it was the fiduciary's duty, and that is, I believe, I just understand it's contained in 13140.
And that uses the word need.
No, Your Honor. But it says that a fiduciary is to disperse and otherwise manage funds, quote, according to the best interest of the beneficiary and the beneficiary's dependents, and in light of the beneficiary's unique circumstances, needs, desires, beliefs, and values. And that's in the regulation.
If I could, though, under 13.120B, it's the VA field examiners that are supposed to assess the beneficiaries and the dependents' welfare and overall financial system situation.
That's correct.
That you're admitting they did not do here. Sorry, I'm not sure. No. Could I follow up on something else the Chief was asking? You were saying that the budget is not binding, and then a lot of your pleadings say that, but in the August 2024 submission from VA, you included a declaration from the fiduciary service, and one of the bullets, it's on page 10 of your PDF, the pension and fiduciary service also stresses that Mrs. Charette is expected to follow the budget outlined in the notification letter dated March 18, which provides that the beneficiary is to receive $100 per month for personal needs. Failure to comply could result in her removal. That doesn't sound voluntary, or how is that not a mandate?
You're right, Your Honor. That's not the way I would word it, but it is, I think, reflective of the fact that the reason she was removed in the first place was that the funds that the veteran required were not provided by her when she was the fiduciary.
But is she now bound by the fiduciary, the budget that you have sent her? You've provided.
How would she know that when it when this submission from you tells her that she is bound by it, essentially?
Again, Your Honor, that's not artfully worded, but I think it is, in essence, a note that it was the failure to provide for the needs of the veteran that was the cause for initial removal.
It's not only not artfully noted, you're saying something completely different from what the analyst from the fiduciary service said.
Well, the current budget is $100 a month for the veteran to receive into that account. I guess if she had a reason to change that, yes, she certainly could do so. And there might be a reason to change that, either up or down. And so, yes, I would agree that if you read that as a mandate that she follow the budget, then that is not correct.
She doesn't need a reason to change it. Am I correct?
She needs a reason.
She doesn't need a reason to change the budget that VA came up with.
She must, in whatever decision she makes about spending, Your Honor, follow her responsibilities.
Her responsibilities are considered the best interests of the veteran.
And there are some others that are laid out in this.
And so how does a $100 requirement from VA, how does that meet the regulation and the statute's requirement that she act in the best interest of the veteran?
Your Honor, as I've conceded, if that's the way you if you read that as a mandate that she follow the budget, that is incorrect.
You just said she needs a reason to diverge from the budget that VA came up with. You specifically just said that.
That you need a reason for any action, and those actions have to, and those reasons have to be that you're acting in the favor of the veteran, right? Any decision you make as the fiduciary is that you are choosing to act in the best interest of the veteran and the veteran's dependents.
And so she does not need a reason to diverge from the budget that VA came up with.
I think we're agreeing, but saying it differently, Your Honor.
We're not agreeing, Mr. McNabb.
Hey, Your Honor. Well, I believe that it's her duty to follow 38 CFR 13.140. Yes, Your Honor.
And so if she believes that $30 a month is sufficient for Mr. McNabb's best interests, she is free to implement that.
Yes, Your Honor.
And she doesn't need to provide any reason to VA.
But VA's duty is not in advance or but if VA inquires, VA's also tasked with overseeing the program, overseeing her appointment, replacing her if she's not acting in the best interest of the veteran. So it may seek information so that it can make a decision about whether someone is acting in the best interest of the veteran. They can't know that in a vacuum. And so they certainly may inquire. And if they make a determination that someone's the current fiduciary is not acting in the best interest of the veteran or the veteran's dependents, then they may make a misuse determination. They may make a new appointment and remove her. All of those things are appealable. None of those things are present here.
And is VA's refusal to release funds a fiduciary's refusal to release funds, is that considered misuse?
Refusal to release funds.
Yeah, like she didn't. The earlier fiduciary did not release funds to her.
Right. The other fiduciary, I don't know that the other fiduciary was particularly aware, and that may be a failing both on the part of the fiduciary and the field exam that resulted in the appointment. But that's.
But just generally, is the failure to release funds? Can that be considered misuse of funds?
Can not using funds be a misuse of funds? I don't know. It certainly can be a reason for removal of the fiduciary because they're not acting in the best interest. A misuse of funds presumes, I think, that they are used. And it results, for instance, after a misuse determination is made, then VA is required to then determine whether it had been adequately overseeing the fiduciary And the reason for that is because if he had not been adequately overseeing the fiduciary, then it would reimburse those misused funds. So that misuse determination is a sort of a first step in determining whether funds need to be replaced or they should be replaced because of VA's failure to oversee the fiduciary who misused the funds. So no, Your Honor, I don't believe that not using the funds would be a misuse. However, they could be very well a reason for removal.
So along those lines, if I could jump in, Chief. In the October 2023 letter that I was discussing with Mr. Rosinski, he outlined not only that the petitioner was seeking reimbursement for the monthly payments she had not received over that period of time, but she also talked about how in this July 2010 fiduciary agreement, she was supposed to get about $3,000 a month out of the veterans benefits to pay her mortgage and her utilities. And she's been telling VA that. 3 months later, you then submitted to the court a declaration that indicates that as of that date, VA had not received any allegations of inappropriate actions by the paid fiduciary. Why is that not an inappropriate action? He wasn't paying any money to the veterans' dependents for more than 5 years. And VA didn't treat that as an allegation of inappropriate action.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. They did not see any of her pleadings as a request to remove and replace that fiduciary.
So if there was some obligation that the fiduciary did not live up to during this time when she was not paid anything from the veterans benefits or that VA field examiners did not live up to their obligations to her, what's the remedy?
The remedy. She is now in control of the fiduciary's funds, and she has a duty to follow, for instance, 38.13.140. That includes for her to determine and pay the just debts of the veterans. So, if that was the circumstance, then
dependents.
Then that would be yes, Your Honor, and so that would be part of her duty.
So given all of that, your acknowledgments that she doesn't, it sounds like you're suggesting she could reimburse herself from this pool of money that has now been transferred to her, that she's the fiduciary over, that she could reimburse herself for some of the expenses she had to pay out of other pots of money. I don't know how she paid her expenses during that time, but can you not resolve this without the court? You're saying she's allowed to do this.
It's possible that one could, but that's unfortunately not where we are today.
And why is that? Given all of the mistakes that have been made in this case over the years, all of the ones you've admitted today, why are you not trying to resolve this matter for Mrs. Charette and her family?
Efforts have been made, Your Honor, but where we stand now is that Mrs. Charette has been appointed. She controls the veterans' funds. She is acting as a fiduciary and should do so in a manner that comports with her agreement and the regulation, and that if she does so in this fashion, as noted, to respond to Judge Lauer's question, it was in the declaration point 19 on page 10 of our most recent filing that indicated that that it was in May that VA was informed that the funds were transferred. That VA received that information on May 3rd, and that was a total of $238,716. In pleadings before this court, petitioners asserted that she wished to have reimbursement of up to $3,212 per month for the months she was not acting as fiduciary. Assuming that to be 71 months, that total would be $228,110.93. That would be just over 95.5% of the funds that were transferred. Now, that number, he's noted, is different today, but of the amount that was transferred, it would be 95.5% of those funds. In VA's oversight capacity, it might need to investigate and gather information as to whether dispersal of over 95% of the funds under management was appropriate. That, we believe, would be, if the decision on that was that she needed to be removed for some reason, then that would be appealable. If the decision on that was that it was misuse, that would be appealable. But all that's in the future, none of that's happened or before us today. And so as we explained in our response to the court's May 1st, 2024 order, the fiduciary is empowered to make decisions, including any such expenditure under 13140. But it's VA's duty to ensure that that fiduciary is acting in the best interest of the veteran, and that they should be, and they would be removed under 13500 if they didn't do so. But the secretary urges the court to deny the petition. One pending matter remains before the agency. There's no substantial delay on that pending matter, and that's to although she's already the fiduciary, to appoint her fiduciary in a way that requires less accounting and no bond.
So, Mr. McNabb, what is your position on the petitioner's ultra vires contentions that indeed the secretary in fiduciary matters and generally, and in Ms. Charette's case in particular, the secretary has acted in a way that's beyond his authority, especially in devising these regulations, some of which he contends are contrary to statute?
Well, Your Honor, his contention that it's contrary to statute was to cite only 38 CFR 1320 and presume that the regulations ended there, that it only said that a fiduciary receives money and that it's left, that there, sort of the other half is not there, but that's not true. 38 CFR 13140 is sort of the other half, which is it lists the duties and the responsibilities of the fiduciary. That's present. But it is VA's duty under the statute to appoint someone to act in the best interest of the veteran. And if they cease to act in the best interest of the veteran, to remove them and appoint someone else. We believe that, is VA's empowered to do. It's what happened here. But now she's appointed. She must serve, and she's serving in that role, and we think there's nothing else here for the court to do once the only pending matter before the agency is concluded, which is its own statement that it's in the process of changing the nature of appointment from a fiduciary in one way with certain responsibilities to a fiduciary in one with less reporting responsibility.
It's very difficult to look at this file in the pleadings without coming away with the conclusion that VA is punishing Ms. Charette for coming to the court and trying to enforce her rights.
Your Honor, she came to the court and expressed that she thought she'd appealed, and we agreed that that a document that was filed by her as the guardian should have been, viewed as a notice of disagreement. And so that's what, but rather than issue a statement of the case and continue the removal, they in fact decided to reappoint her. So I think all that happened here was that the agency failed to recognize an NOD in the prior Charette case, and then since then, it's acted to appoint her. And it did so in a way that it conceded included an error in terms of how she was appointed, but she was appointed, and they are now correcting the error of the nature of her appointment.
Uh-huh. And what about their estrangement decision, non-decision?
That was the error, Your Honor. That is incorrect information, and as it was the only basis that they used for the type of appointment they made, they indicated that was, therefore, something that they were going to change because the only basis for the nature of the appointment they made was incorrect. And so that's what they're in the process of correcting now.
And that takes 45 days to correct?
Well, Your Honor, their processes include this field exam that they are required to do and that they made an initial call, but it's not a complete field exam. They need to complete that.
So the field exam will be what? Visiting the veteran in the medical center and then... I mean, it's impossible for Mrs. Charette to be co-located with her veteran husband. How much more goes into correcting this mistake?
Well, they will speak to her, but as they did last time, they didn't. While they can do it in person, they did so over the telephone, and it's my understanding that they intend to do that again.
So what else would they be seeking other than to confirm that he's still in the medical center in Indiana, and she could be anywhere?
Yes, Your Honor. I think what they'd be seeking is the same sort of information that they generally seek, which is to have an ability to oversee and to make sure that she's acting in the best interest of the veteran. And so that includes things like gathering the budgetary information so that they would have information, they would have a basis to oversee. So it's that.
What's an example that the VA would use of some misuse by the current fiduciary?
I'm unaware of any misuse by the current fiduciary.
I mean, when you look at the requirements per the fiduciary agreement and the regulation, they're pretty broad. So it would have to be something that's not in the best interest of the veteran or dependent or dependents. In this case, there's one dependent. That's Mrs. Charette.
Yes, Your Honor.
So can you provide an example of something that would not be in the best interest given the language in the agreement and the regulation? Because I'm having a hard time. I've got something in mind, but I don't want to share it, but I would like to hear from you. So you're telling the court it takes 45 days to change the type of fiduciary to a less restricted, let's call it spouse fiduciary or family fiduciary. It's going to take 45 days to confirm that they're living in separate places because they have to. And then you're saying that there is a requirement to make sure that the fiduciary, regardless, is acting in the best interest of both the beneficiary or veteran and the dependent, which in this case is Mrs. Charette. So please provide an example.
Well, Your Honor, I guess there's 2 points to that. I don't have a specific example, Your Honor, of what misuse might be. But I would say that regarding the 45 days, I think that was simply, again, they need to make appointments to speak to Mrs. Charette, et cetera. That may happen much faster. But they tried to give the court an indication of how long it would take. But there's no reason.
How long has it been so far?
Well, Your Honor.
Of the 45 days, where are we approximately?
I think less than 2 weeks. It's my understanding that that they did call Ms. Charette the next day to begin the process, that counsel was concerned that there'd be communication at this point and asked that that not continue until we had this order. So they've not then taken further steps to complete this action, but this is my understanding due to the request of counsel. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. McNabb.
I hope the court now understands why I reserved 15 minutes. There are numerous misstatements that need to be clarified here, and I'll start with Judge Lahr's inquiries about this field exam. An important point was they just completed a field exam to reappoint her a few months ago. They are demanding a second field exam within the same calendar quarter, I believe. I don't know why. They didn't contact us ahead of time. Somebody called Ms. Charette, started asking all sorts of questions about her funds. She told them she needed to talk to me. We finally figured it out that that's what they were doing. And then I was told it's going to, oh, they got to do all the same things they just did a few months before to hassle this woman. Where it is, I don't know. You may take a hint from this that there are reasons why we're not agreeing to settle this case for future promises from the fiduciary group. You also heard why we need a court order. As I heard, they're still scouring the record. They're not making, they specifically said there were strings attached to the payment. That, oh yeah, she can pay herself, but another office may investigate her and determine that she misused it. Or another office may find it's not in the veteran's best interest. We're not going to sign up for that. You either order payment or you don't. She either can pay herself, but she's not going to pay herself and then end up in IRS heck again because you heard the strings and there's others. Let me go down the list of issues with what the secretary stated. First of all, you still didn't hear any response to the A1 section that says he's only allowed to direct payments to certain people. You also didn't hear any response about what a fiduciary is inherently authorized by Congress. They have a regulation that lists the duties. We have no problem with that, okay? List the fiduciary's duties, not the secretary's duties. The secretary can monitor those, we agree, but that's not what's going on. You can look up anything in this case, or any of the other cases that I'll identify here in a minute, and that is not what's going on. The grossest misstatement was that a fiduciary can do whatever they want as far as the budget. I have a list, and I have submitted it in one of my pleadings of cases where that's exactly what happened. In the Garcia case, they fired the daughter because she dared to buy heart medicine after her father had a heart attack before VA people, not the fiduciary. She was the fiduciary. She bought the medicine, they fired her for misuse, not getting approval. I had an elderly couple in Ohio, I believe, or Indiana, and I believe maybe, Judge Barley, you were involved in this, where they refused to accept the printed out receipts for electricity. The fiduciary with VA told him he couldn't accept it from the screen. They wanted a hard copy bill. The utility didn't send hard copy bills. You had to go up and pay electronically. They cut the power to that house because the fiduciary hadn't paid the bill in 3 months when it was 100 degrees outside. And there was an emergency petition, and the VA made some calls and got the electricity turned on 2 days later. I don't know. I refer you to, and those are just my cases. I've got a list of them, six or seven of them there, where you dare spend a dollar, $5. And speaking of the $5, the pants issue, what happened was they said she wasn't contributing enough to the veterans fund so he could go off site for hamburgers, I believe was the exact issue. The new fiduciary started putting $100 or $150. That was the only item on the budget. 6 months later, he wrote a letter or an email to the fiduciary people saying, there's $1,000 in this account. He never goes off site. He can't. Please tell me I can take this out. He's asking permission to stop putting money in an account that Mrs. Charette can't get and the veteran, who is bedridden, can't use. That is the exact issue that they fired her for. Misuse, not spending enough on pants, and not spending enough on money for hamburgers the guy couldn't get. And as far as communications and the VA oversight, they sure say a lot, they do a lot in oversight. Well, let's remember, this fiduciary that replaced Mrs. Charette filed tax returns, and I have the emails back, he didn't know she was married. Or he was married. He filed single and then told VA, no one told me he was married. How is that guy supposed to be making decisions about how much money Mrs. Charette? They told him nothing about Mrs. Charette. No one ever called her and actually got anything from her, but so they made it zero. Oh, she won't talk. One of those cases is about an interview with a veteran who the examiner said was unresponsive. Because he was sleeping during the entire interview. So I'm setting the budget at $600. That's documented in one of those cases before the court. If you accept that these field examiners do what supposedly they've done, look at this case and look at those cases. They never got any information. They didn't ask for information. And in no case does a beneficiary family get to have any input. When the field examiners went to one of those other cases in South Carolina, they refused to believe that the family had moved because they didn't get authorization from the fiduciary hub. They moved 90 miles closer to the VAMC in Columbia. They refused. They charged them with faking their driver's licenses and charged the son for forging the veteran's signature on a mortgage, not understanding that he had the power of attorney. Actually, they didn't understand what a power of attorney was to sign the mortgage for his father. I can't take any more of this field examiner's do this and do that. If you'll notice, everything in here they say Mrs. Charette didn't do. She's not supposed to do anything. No communications, no requests to the secretary. They went to state court and got an order from the state court judge. The VA doesn't know about the lawsuit. They ran it. Not to mention the letters and stuff she did after I became. She had a state lawyer writing letters. There's half a dozen letters, and they filed suit against them for not paying her. Talk about this conservation catch-22. There's a rule, regulation, that says you're supposed to conserve just the right amount. Meaning you keep how much funds you keep in trust, which the VA has their grip on, and how much you can pay out. The VA has routinely used that and is using it here as a catch-22. If you keep too much, you don't pay out enough, they beat you up for trying to hide the money for the survivors. If you pay too much, they say you're not meeting the future needs of the veteran. That's what they did here. The latest round of stuff was conservation. I had another souls about that. And actually, the replacement guy had a worse percentage because he was paying out less. He grew the fund the most. They didn't charge him with that. And again, you cannot, as you said, Chief Judge, you cannot read the record in this case or any of the other 8 or 9 or 10 cases of my own, not to mention others, and come out with anything near that the fiduciaries run this program or the fiduciaries are not agents of the secretary under continuous threat of removal. And for some of these fiduciaries, this is their income. It seems to have two levels. People that were, in an actual case, a carpenter who retired, and 3 months later he's in charge of a dozen veterans with some kind of correspondence course, or professionals who have dozens or hundreds of veterans under their care. There's one in Charleston. She has over 100 phone numbers and utility bills assigned to her. They don't bother them. They're not supposed to have 100. They don't bother them. And whenever some family member barks down in Columbia, that woman gets the case. So that is why this is a much more important case than looks, not only hundreds of thousands of dollars for a woman who hasn't been able to live with her husband for 25 years, okay? But because it exposes many, not all, many of the complete imbalances of statutory authority and how they do it. And I want to point out a case which I have not yet cited. City of Arlington, 569 U.S. 299. To exceed authorized application is to exceed authority. And in context, that means you might be authorized to do something, but if you do it in such a way that is not supposed to be authorized or wasn't intended, that's the same thing. So even if you read the statute that says you can give the veterans money to somebody to take care of, authorize all this other stuff, this other stuff is not what Congress intended. You cannot have a fiduciary who is contractually required to do things Congress did not want and could not be argued to want. Why do we have any of these people if all they're going to do is listen to the fiduciary service individuals or have to? And if you don't believe it's a binding contract, please look at 77 Fed Register 39345 at 39346, where it says the form, the fiduciary form that's required to be signed by the fiduciary people and the fiduciary, the pseudo, the fiduciary who wants to be appointed, is a, quote, binding contract between VA and federally appointed fiduciaries, end quote. They are, at most, using a contract or pseudo-contract to force people who want, in the vast majority, want to do good. It's not their income, their rice bowl, although there are too many of those. Mrs. Charette is just trying to take care of her husband. And while she was struggling with other family things, they swept in and said, you're not sending dockers anymore. Where all the dockers went is another issue. But she stopped sending them because her husband never left his bed. And sweatpants were more comfortable for him. And they fired her. And they wouldn't restore her until we came to this court the first time. Now they restored her, and they're making her jump through all the hoops to just change the title. 90 days. They fired her in a week without any notice. They can't reappoint her. Last time they said they had no process to put this back as status quo ante. You know what? They were right. They have no process to fix in their errors. That is why this court, I'm going to use the word, must do something. I've been doing this for two decades. Freeman opened the door to just this kind of case. And yet, because I haven't been successful in getting this teed up, this case passes the Lorry test of the case here. There is no previous precedent. So under Loper Bright, this court, has every right and duty to say what the best reading of the law is. And I cannot see any reading other than an unobjective, subjective reading to just post hoc justify what they do, then this case, this group is out of control. And with that, I will stop unless there's any other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Brzezinski.
Thank you very much.
The case is submitted for consideration. The court is adjourned, and the court will come down and greet counsel.
All rise.